Welcome to another Salvation by Grace midweek message. Salvation by Grace is the teaching ministry of Grace Christian Assembly, a Sovereign Grace Fellowship in Smyrna, Tennessee. You'll find us on the internet at salvationbygrace.org. We are currently studying the minor prophets of the Old Testament. So grab your Bible and join the congregation of GCA, along with our teaching pastor, Jim McClarty.
Tonight we are starting in Zechariah 10. Ideally, we will get to Zechariah 10 and 11 tonight. Zechariah 11 is admittedly some of the most difficult and obscure language, not only in Zechariah, but in all of the Old Testament. And yet, the best way to understand the language is to not only look at the overall context of the book of Zechariah, but to understand the overall context of the Bible. I know you've heard me pound away at this for years and years, but context determines meaning, and we're really going to see an example of that in trying to understand Zechariah 11 here. If you understand the book of Daniel, and if you have that extra help of Matthew 24 or Paul's writing to the Thessalonians, or even the book of Revelation, then you have some sense of the order of events that are laid out in biblical eschatology. Last week we saw that God said that he was going to defend Jerusalem, that he was going to defend Judah, that he was going to defend the northern tribes, Jacob, and that he was going to restore them. He was going to bring them back to their land. That's what chapter 10 concentrates on, is this ongoing promise that we see again from all of the Old Testament prophets of the ultimate regathering and blessing of both Judah and Ephraim. All 12 tribes collectively are going to be gathered back. But then having that promise in place, and like I said, all of the prophets say that this is going to happen, when we look at our current situation, the way the world is right now, Israel is yet again scattered. Up until 1948, they were out of their land completely. But the Bible also accounts for that, because that's what chapter 11 is about. That after once again restoring Judah, and that's really the time frame of Zechariah and Haggai, the rebuilding of the temple, the rebuilding of Jerusalem, and the promises that are given to the Jews to encourage them in that rebuilding project, Zechariah keeps looking off into the distance and saying, God is faithful to you. He is going to regather you. He is going to establish you. And Jerusalem is going to one day be nothing but peace and prosperity, and the holiness of the Lord is going to break out, and the nations of the earth are going to receive blessings that flow through Jerusalem out to them. So that's the long-term promise that is the encouragement to start rebuilding. But if you also know your history, you know that come 70 AD, that the Romans destroy most of the area through Judah, take out Jerusalem, take out the temple again, and that the temple in Jerusalem has not been rebuilt since that time. But then there is this time of trouble coming that Daniel talks about and that Jeremiah talks about, this time of trouble such as never was or ever would be again. Jesus mentions it and even ties Daniel to that prophecy. Jeremiah refers to that time as the time of Jacob's trouble. And because it is a future thing, it lays between the rebuilding of the temple, the destruction of the temple, and the ultimate fruition of all those promises that God has made to Israel and Judah. And that very much is what chapter 11 is about. Chapter 10 makes the promise. Chapter 11 is God yet again scattering Israel, scattering Judah, and even saying, I'm going to send them a bad shepherd, and that bad shepherd is going to scatter them. It's clearly a reference to Daniel's little horn. It's clearly a reference to the one that we nicknamed the Antichrist, the one who is going to come and make peace with Israel. And then, starting at chapter 12 through chapter 14, there's the return of Christ. Israel collectively looks on him whom they have pierced. God pours out the spirit of supplication on them. And that is the final culmination of all these promises that we've been seeing in the latter part of Zechariah of reestablishment, rebuilding, regathering yet again. So the biblical timeline is reflected here in Zechariah again. But the language itself, as I said, can be a little on the obtuse side. It can be a little poetic. And yet, if you look at it through the eyes of the timeline that is laid out by Daniel, that is laid out by even Ezekiel, that is laid out in Revelation, that is laid out in Thessalonians, if you look at that timeline, I think we can understand Zechariah 10 and 11. So the timeline, just to be clear, that the Bible lays out and that Zechariah is dependent on, is that God established Israel and Judah in their land, brought them out of Egypt, brought them to their land. Because of their following after other gods, intermingling with the surrounding nations, being drawn away from him, he took the northern 10 tribes into the Assyrian captivity. They have never, since that period, been reestablished back in their land. The Assyrians also planted people in that land to till the land, keep the land, keep the wild animals from taking over the land. Those people also intermingled with the last of the Israelites who were still in the area. And they became known as the Samaritans. The Samaritans were hated by the Jews because they were half-breeds. Judah continued on, and Ezekiel tells us that Judah is more guilty than the northern tribes Israel, even gives them a name, Ahola and Aholibah, and says that they are two sisters who go into prostitution. And that one sister, Judah, saw what God did to her sister, saw how Israel was scattered, taken into captivity, out of their land. And so that should have been more inspiration for them to not go down the path of their sister, and yet they did it anyway. So Judah was really, really guilty, and as a consequence, they go into the Babylonian captivity. However, all the way back in the book of Genesis, Jacob, when he is dying, leans on his staff and prophesies about what is going to happen in the last days for each of his 12 sons. And as he's laying that out, he specifically says that Judah is going to be the tribe that is going to produce the Messiah. He's the one through whom Shiloh is going to come. And that the law-giving, the crown, is not going to depart from Judah. And so God needs to reestablish Judah for long enough for Jesus to get here. And so that's what time we're looking at right here. After 70 years in Babylon, they are then brought back to their land again to rebuild the walls, to rebuild the temple, and they continue on until Jesus comes, and then 70 AD comes, and then he destroys Jerusalem again, and they are scattered yet again. Despite the fact that they have these promises of gathering, regathering of all 12 tribes, the kind of regathering and reestablishment that causes Paul in the book of Romans to say that all Israel will be saved, because he knows what the prophets have said, that even though they're in that scattered state, even though they're under the punishment of God, that punishment is going to culminate in a time of trouble such as never was or ever would be again. And commensurate with that time of trouble is this Antichrist little horn character And then Christ returns, mops up the floor with all the kingdoms of the world. Daniel's stone kingdom crushes all the kingdoms of this world and establishes a kingdom that's never going to end. That's the big timeline. And once you know that big timeline, you can make sense out of chapter 11 of Zechariah. But we're never going to be able to do that if I don't shut up and read 10. So we need to look at chapter 10 first, which again is a restatement of these promises of blessing and reestablishment and regathering for Judah and for Israel. By the way, Israel, the northern 10 tribes, go by a couple of nicknames. They're sometimes called Ephraim, sometimes Mount Ephraim, because Ephraim was the primary tribe of the northern kingdoms, and because Ephraim and Manasseh are the two sons of Joseph, they are also sometimes called collectively Joseph. And that's the language you're going to see here in chapter 10. All right, let's see if we can get this all in tonight. But I think the introduction was important. Ask rain from Yahweh at the time of the spring rain. We don't feel that the same way that an agricultural culture would. But you have to have, it is necessary that you have regular rain in the spring and in the fall in order to have your times of growth and harvest. And so they are dependent on God to produce this rain because this is something they cannot produce for themselves. So God says, ask for rain from Yahweh at the time of the spring rain because Yahweh makes the storm clouds. And he will give them showers of rain, vegetation in the field for every man. For the teraphim speak iniquity. That word teraphim is idols. It's particularly the household idols. And so here is God saying, I'm the only God that is. I am Yahweh. I'm the one that creates everything. I'm the one that brings the blessings. I'm the one that brings the rain, which is why you have vegetation, which is why you have things to eat. And if you are still praying to your household idols, they can't help you. They can't do anything for you. Yahweh is comparing himself to the deadness of idols. For the teraphim speak iniquity, and the diviners, those that see dreams and predict the future, see lying visions, and they tell false dreams, and they comfort you in vain. You may recall as we were going through the book of Jeremiah how frequently Jeremiah was the only prophet in Israel telling the truth about what was really going to happen. You are going to go into Babylon. You are going to be conquered. You're going to be there for 70 years. While all the other prophets were saying, no, that's not going to happen. No, they speak comfort to the people. They tell the people what the people want to hear rather than telling them the truth. And so he says, that's what the false diviners, the false prophets do. They tell you false dreams and they comfort you in vain. Therefore, when that happens, the people wander like sheep and they are afflicted. They are oppressed because there is no shepherd. My anger is kindled against the shepherds. He's talking about the leaders within Judah. The leaders that have led them down this path that led to idolatry. My anger is kindled against your leaders, your shepherds. And I will punish, the word technically here is male goats, but the same way that the male goats lead a flock, he's talking about the leaders again. I will punish your leaders. For Yahweh of hosts, he uses this word repeatedly. Zechariah keeps pointing out that Yahweh of armies is the one who is in charge of everything and therefore can proclaim what he is going to accomplish. For Yahweh of armies has visited his flock, the house of Judah, and will make them like his majestic horse in battle. From them will come the cornerstone, obviously a reference to Christ. Through Judah, just like Jacob predicted, through Judah is going to come the cornerstone on which everything else is built. From them will come the tent peg. He's the chief one. Without him, you don't have any structure at all. From them will come the bow of the battle. From them, every ruler of them together. Just like Jacob said, through Judah, Shiloh is going to come. The cornerstone is going to come. The ultimate ruler is going to come through Judah. And they will be as mighty men, treading down the enemy in the dirt, in the mire of the streets of battle. And they will fight, for Yahweh will be with them. And the riders on horses, the enemy riders that come raging in on their horses, will be put to shame. And I will strengthen the house of Judah, and I will save the house of Joseph. Okay, now that's all 12 tribes. That's northern and southern kingdom. I will strengthen Judah, and I will save the house of Joseph. And I will bring them back, because I have had compassion on them. And they will be as though I had not rejected them. For I am Yahweh, their God, and I will answer them. Now, when God says, I will, is there any chance he won't?
Nope.
No. Once he tells you what his will is, what his desire is, what his plan is, then this is something he is absolutely going to accomplish. It's going to be like they had never been rejected. He is going to reply and answer and listen, and he is going to make them the chief nation among all the nations of earth. Ephraim will be like a mighty man, and they're going to be happy about it. Their heart will be glad as if from wine. Indeed, their children will see it and be glad, and their heart will rejoice in Yahweh. I will whistle for them. In other words, I'll call them together, and I will gather them together, for I have redeemed them. And they will be as numerous as they were before. When I scatter them among the peoples, they will remember me in the far countries, and they, with their children, will live and come back. I will bring them back. It's a real interesting couplet there. I just want to point out that there is a human reaction to what God has already determined to do. The human reaction is going to be in all the nations, in all the countries where God has scattered them, while they are there, they're going to remember their God. They're going to be surrounded by all the foreign gods and the foreign worship, but they're going to recall their God in those far countries where they are, and then they and their children will survive, will live, will come back. And then verse 11, I will bring them back, because it's ultimately God doing the bringing, but his people also react to him when he says what he's going to do, when he willingly brings them to himself. And this is the way the God of the Bible always works. We just saw that from Jesus, that he said, no man can come to me except the Father draws him, and all that the Father gives me will come to me. And so there is a reaction by God's people, but it is still God's will that is accomplishing the things that are happening among his people. And he will regather them. He will bring them back to their country. I will bring them back from the land of Egypt. I will gather them from Assyria. And I will bring them into the land of Gilead and Lebanon, until there's no more room found for them. Now, by the way, the fact that he's saying, I'm going to bring them into Gilead and Lebanon, that's like the northern and eastern extremes pushing out the edges of what we know as Israel, hearkening back to the original promise that God made to Abraham, which was that he was going to ultimately give him all the land all the way out to the Euphrates River, all the way south to the Nile. Here he's explaining the expansion of Israel when he regathers them, that they're not going to be able to populate just the land we know as Israel right now. There's going to be too many of them. And so they are going to stretch out into the land of Gilead and into Lebanon until no room can be found for them. And they will pass through the sea of distress, but no worry, because he will strike the waves of the sea so that all the depths of the Nile will dry up, and the pride of Assyria will be brought down, and the scepter, the rulership of Egypt, will depart. In other words, every hindrance that would stand in the way of my people coming back to their own land, I'm going to destroy every single hindrance. I'm the same God who brought them out of Egypt through the Red Sea, and I'm going to do that again. I will dry up the Nile. I will make sure that my people can all get back to me. And the arrogance, the pride of the Assyrians who took the northern tribes into captivity, that pride is going to be crushed by God. The scepter, the rulership of Egypt will depart, and I will strengthen them in myself. I will strengthen them in Yahweh, and in his name they will walk. They will live out their lives, declares Yahweh. Okay, so is there any chance that's not going to happen?
No chance.
Okay, so that promise exists. And that is a promise consistent with what we have seen through all the prophets that we have looked at in the Old Testament. When they talk about Israel and talk about Judah, they all across the board speak with one voice and say that there is a time coming when God is going to reunite northern and southern tribes, reestablish them in their own land, give them David's greater son to sit on his throne and rule over them. But before that happens, there's a time of trouble such as never was. And there's Daniel's little horn. And there is disaster yet again for them. It is the time of Jacob's trouble. And that is what chapter 11 is about. And the reason that this is all going to happen is because, like we read last week, out of Zechariah 9, the promise from God was, your king is coming to you, lowly and riding on a donkey. Okay, that actually happened. He rode into Jerusalem. We looked at it. He rode into Jerusalem on a donkey and on a colt that nobody had ever ridden on before. Okay, that actually happened. In chapter 11, we're going to hear that they reject that king. Here God has sent them the king, and they're going to recognize him because he's going to enter into Jerusalem as a humble king. And then they reject that king. And the detail that Zechariah includes is really astounding, because in chapter 11, he's even going to include the price that Judas was paid to betray Jesus. So there's no question who he's talking about. He's talking about Jesus, but then he's talking about the ultimate betrayal of Jesus leading to the death of Jesus, and then the event that follows that is the destruction of Jerusalem again, and then the Antichrist comes, and then this time of trouble such as never was or ever would be again. That is the consistent biblical timeline. Verse 1, chapter 11 of the book of Zechariah. Open your doors, O Lebanon, that a fire may feed on your cedars. Now he's starting to describe the destruction that's going to happen to the areas surrounding Jerusalem, leading up to the fall of Jerusalem again. Wail, O Cyprus, for the cedar has fallen, because the glorious trees have been destroyed. So wail, O oaks of Bashan, for the impenetrable forest has come down. There is a sound of the shepherd's wail, for their glory is ruined. There is a sound of the young lions roaring, for the pride of the Jordan is ruined. That's probably a reference to the fact that young lions lived in the thick forests, and if those areas are destroyed, then the young lions are going to roar because they have no place to live. And it's because Jordan itself is all ruined. Okay, now that, I believe, is describing the beginning of the Roman occupation of that area of Judah that is ultimately going to culminate in the destruction of Jerusalem, because there is this description of all the areas, the best areas, the trees with which they are doing all their building. These cedar trees were coming from Lebanon. If you destroy all of that, then it is a time of great mourning, a great sorrow. So there is this sorrowful time coming that is represented in the first three verses in a poetic form. Verse 4, thus says Yahweh, my God. This is apparently an instruction to Zechariah. Pasture the flock that is doomed to slaughter. Now, the word doomed is added by the translators. It is implied by what is written, but he is told to go and pasture the flock. Go care for the flock that is destined to be destroyed. Are you comfortable with a God who is so sovereign that he can tell his prophet, now go and pasture these people, and they are going to build Jerusalem, they're going to build the temple, and they're going to remain in this land now for a couple hundred years, but the ultimate end of them is destruction. Then comes the reestablishment and the regathering and all that. But meanwhile, I want you to go and look after, like a shepherd, the flock that is doomed to slaughter. Those who buy them will slay them and go unpunished. And each of those who sell them says, blessed be Yahweh, for I have become rich. And their own shepherds have no pity on them. What a terrible description of what's going to happen to these people. They're going to be sold into slavery again. They're going to be destroyed. They're going to be killed. The people who slay them aren't even going to be punished for what they've done. Instead, they're going to brag and say, the God of Israel didn't bless them. He ended up blessing me because I became rich off of them. And their own shepherds, their own leaders, won't have any pity for them. You can see why God is angry at the shepherds. For I will no longer have pity on the inhabitants of the land, declares the Lord. But behold, I will cause the men to fall, each into another's power. In other words, they are going to fall by the sword. They are going to fall into slavery by the power of a different nation. People who aren't like them. People who are not Jews. People who don't speak their language. Each of them are going to fall into another's power and into the power of his king. I believe that that is the time of the destruction as Rome and the Roman leaders, the Roman kings, are going to conquer over Jerusalem. And they will strike the land, and I will not deliver them from their power. If you know anything about 70 AD, you know that it was one of the worst times for Israel in their history. I mean, even to the point of hundreds, thousands of people being crucified around the walls of Jerusalem, and even cannibalism broke out within the walls because they couldn't get outside the walls to get food. I mean, it was just a horrible time. So, says Zechariah, I did what I was told, and I pastured the flock that was doomed to slaughter. Hence the afflicted or the oppressed of the flock. And I took for myself two staffs, and one I called favor or grace or kindness. And the other I called union, is the NASB translation. Technically, it's bonds, that they're bound together. Now, later on, we're going to find out that that staff that said bond on it or said union on it was representing the union between the northern and the southern kingdoms. because when he destroys that staff, there is a separation between those kingdoms. But there's also favor, there's also grace, there's also God's protection and God looking over them. So I pastured the flock, verse 8. Then I annihilated the three shepherds in 1 month. Boy, if you wanna just kill an afternoon, go online and start reading commentaries about what verse 8 means. Because there are so many interpretations of who these three shepherds are. The most, I think, consistent that I came across, the one that I think is most probable, is that Israel was led through their entire history by prophet, priest, and king. And that may very well be the three shepherds, the office of the prophet and the priest and the king, that also become destroyed as Rome destroys the city, destroys their social structure. For my soul was impatient with them, and their soul was also weary of me. By the way, just an interesting little note, as I was going through these various different commentaries, the word weary right there is a Hebrew word that is only found in the entire Old Testament, found right there. And it's a word that means sick to the point of nausea. Verse 9, then I said, I will not pasture you. What is to die, let it die. And what is to be annihilated, let it be annihilated. And let those who are left eat one another's flesh. That actually happened, 70 AD. I took my staff, favor, and I cut it into pieces to break my covenant which I had made with all these peoples. Remember, this is Zechariah talking, not God. The covenant he is breaking is his agreement to pasture them, to be a shepherd over them, to look after them. So I took my staff favor and I cut it into pieces and I broke my covenant, my promise, which I had made with all the peoples. So it was broken on that day. And thus the afflicted or the oppressed of the flock who were watching me realized that it was the word of the Lord. That what was happening to them, what they were encountering, what they were going through is exactly what God told them they were going to go through. Where will they find that? Well, in everything I've already mentioned, in the book of Daniel, this time of trouble such as never was, ever would be again, the destruction of Jerusalem that is ultimately coming. But then Jesus himself, when he's on the planet, when they show him the temple, he says, there's not one stone here that's going to be left standing. This destruction of Jerusalem is very clear, and the people are also going to realize that it is the very word of a sovereign God that is bringing these events about. And I said to them, if it's good in your sight, then give me my wages. But if not, hold your peace. Be silent. In the NASB, it's never mind. So they weighed out 30 shekels of silver as my wages. At this point, Zechariah is being a type of Christ. He is the one who came to shepherd them that they rejected to the point where they were sick of him, to the point where they hated him and didn't want to do things his way anymore. And as a consequence, he takes his hand off them and Jerusalem, the temple, is all destroyed. If it is good in your sight, then give me my wages, but if not, never mind. So they weighed out 30 shekels of silver as my wages. Turn to Matthew 26 for just a moment. Keep your finger where it is. Turn to Matthew 26. Matthew 26, I'm going to start reading at verse 14. Then one of the 12, named Judas Iscariot, went to the chief priests and said, what are you willing to give me I like the word willing there. This is really, really interesting. What are you willing to give me to betray him to you? And they weighed out 30 pieces of silver to him. In other words, they did exactly what their will chose to do. This is what they were willing to do. And they coughed up exactly the amount that Zechariah said they were going to. Exactly like God said they were going to do. So, a quick question. We know what their will was, and we know what God's will was. And it turns out that their will perfectly coincided with God's will, and not God's will perfectly coincided with their will. In other words, there's only one will that ever gets it always right all the time. And that's the will of God. And people are going to end up doing what God wills. So they weighed out 30 pieces of silver for him. And from then on, he began looking for a good opportunity to betray Jesus. And then go forward for a moment to chapter 27. I'm going to start reading from verse 1. Now when morning came, all of the chief priests and the elders of the people conferred together against Jesus to put him to death. And they bound him and they led him away and they delivered him to Pilate the governor. And when Judas, who had betrayed him, saw that he had been condemned, he felt remorse and returned the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and the elders, saying, I have sinned by betraying innocent blood. But they said, what is that to us? You see to that yourself. And he threw the pieces of silver into the temple sanctuary, and he departed, and he went away, and he hanged himself. The chief priests took the pieces of silver and said, it is not lawful to put them into the temple treasury, since it is a price of blood. And they conferred together, and with the money they bought the potter's field as a burial place for strangers. And for this reason, that field has been called the field of blood to this very day. Then that which was spoken through Jeremiah the prophet was fulfilled. And they took 30 pieces of silver, the price of the one whose price had been set by the sons of Israel, and they gave them for a potter's field as the Lord directed me. Turn back to Zechariah 11. If it is good in your sight, says verse 12, give me my wages, but if not, never mind. So they weighed out 30 shekels of silver for my wages. And the Lord said to me, throw it to the potter. What a surprise. Zechariah perfectly predicted exactly what was going to happen with the price of betrayal that was the reward that Judas accepted for betraying Jesus as the people were rejecting him. God either got really lucky or else none of that was a mistake. He knew exactly what he was doing. The Lord said to me, throw it to the potter. And then a little bit of sarcasm on God's part. I like the sarcasm of God. That magnificent price at which I was valued by them. In other words, the life of Jesus could be traded off for 30 pieces of silver. Oh, what a grand price. You became filthy rich. Oh, 30 pieces of silver. Oh, that magnificent price at which I was valued by them. So I took the 30 shekels of silver and I threw them to the potter in the house of the Lord. Then I cut in pieces my second staff, Union, to break the brotherhood between Judah and Israel. And the Lord said to me, you're going to take up once again the job of being a shepherd. But this time, you're going to be an evil shepherd. NASB says a foolish shepherd. It means a pointless, a vain, an empty shepherd. This, I believe, is all referring to the Antichrist to come. The Lord said to me, take again for yourself the equipment of a foolish shepherd. For behold, I'm going to raise up a shepherd in the land who will not care for the perishing, seek the scattered, heal the broken, or sustain the one who's still standing, but will devour the flesh of the fat sheep and tear off their hoofs. So he again uses this sheep shepherd analogy to say that a good shepherd would actually look after his own, would actually care for those that were scattered, would actually heal those that are broken. But this one isn't going to care at all for the sheep. In fact, he's going to devour the sheep. He's going to cut off their hooves so that they're not even able to stand on their own. Verse 17, woe to that worthless shepherd who leaves the flock. A sword will be on his arm and on his right eye. Again, commentators don't agree about what that phraseology means. The most common interpretation that I have found is that the right arm is power and that the right eye is the ability to see and to know things, and that God is going to cut him off so completely that with a sword, he's going to cut off his power, his arm, and going to cut off his right eye, his knowledge. His arm will be totally withered, and his right eye will be blinded. Okay, if that's talking about the Antichrist, then according to Daniel, that little horn is going to be utterly destroyed when Christ comes back. And what a surprise, starting in chapter 12 through chapter 14, we have the return of Christ, the ultimate return of Christ, when Israel collectively is going to see him. His feet are going to touch the Mount of Olives. It's going to cleave in half. They're going to look on him whom they have pierced and weep as a mother weeps over her only child. In other words, the timeline is consistent. And the timeline that Zechariah sets out is the same as the timeline that we have learned from Daniel. It's the same timeline that we see in Revelation. It's the same timeline as Matthew 24. So no matter who you're reading, no matter what you're looking at in the Bible, the story is the same because the Bible has one author. And even though different prophets and Jesus himself describe these things, they all describe it consistent with each other. Now, these last three chapters will take 2 weeks to get through, but it is some of the most messianic language that you're going to find in the Old Testament. And what we know so far is Zechariah has said, your king is coming to you. Here's what he's going to look like. He's going to be humble. He's not going to be like most kings riding on a white horse, the great conqueror. He's going to come in on a donkey. He's going to be meek and lowly. But your king is going to come to you. And then you're going to reject him. You're going to reject him and sell him and let the false leaders kill him. Those false shepherds that are leading Jerusalem are going to lead the way to the death of Jesus. And then the next thing that's going to happen is I am yet again going to destroy Jerusalem. I'm yet again going to destroy the temple. And then there's going to come this time of trouble such as never was or ever would be again. And as we read, no flesh would survive if it weren't for the fact that Christ himself is going to come back. God is going to cut that time short. And the shortening of that time is the return of Christ in power and glory. He's going to come back with 10,000s of his saints. And he is going to establish that long-awaited kingdom that he's been talking about all the way through the Old Testament, that gospel of the kingdom that Jesus was talking about while he was here on the planet before his death, and that kingdom that the New Testament authors are also looking forward to, including the description in the book of Revelation. So Zechariah is sandwiched right in the middle of all that, and yet tells the same consistent story, hence pre-everythingist. This is why I am not amillennial. That scheme doesn't fit into even Zechariah, any less the whole context of the Bible. It's why I'm not post-millennial, because the scheme of the Bible, I think, is very obvious and laid out very consistently. All right, I need to stop talking and let you go home. I hope you enjoyed that.
Thank you for listening to this week's Salvation by Grace midweek message. We encourage you to visit our website at salvationbygrace.org for books, articles, and our ever-expanding archive of audio sermons. And we invite you to join us next time when we gather around the Word and study the sovereign grace of God.